James, were you having the same issue with Zoom as I was?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Because, yeah, I send you the Zoom. Like, it took me forever. For some reason, I had, like, an update. But then after the update, I couldn't figure out how to open it. It just kept loading and not responding.
Okay.
And you got to love technology.
Yeah.
You can't assume things are going to work the same way you left them. You come back to your computer and you're like, everything should just turn on and everything should be exactly how I left it. And it's never the case.
No, but I remember distinctly when I was young, my my computer programmer brother would always tell me, you know, it's only human error. Computers don't make mistakes. Sure thing, brother.
I guess you could probably make an argument for that, right? Like, because if there is a glitch in the system, this it had to be a mistake. I guess I could see both perspectives. Because there are sometimes stuff just happens, unpredictable stuff that nobody could foresee. Yeah. Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah. But don't worry. The social planners will be able to fine-tune and engineer society so that everyone has a nice, happy, functioning role in it. And don't worry. Just leave it up to your leaders.
Yeah, well, we haven't talked in a while. And there's a bunch of stuff. I love getting your perspective on, obviously, if people aren't following the CorbettReport.com, please do.
What are they doing?
What
Come
are
on.
They doing? Yeah, how dare
Not
they?
Not following Corbett Report. Ridiculous.
Well, it is. It's wild how far we've come, though. And I should, when I say we, I really mean you. Because it, I mean, to think about, you have interviewed somebody who's run for president, right? Kennedy. You've done work with the Children Health Defense. You were on the High Wire. You're on Dr. Drew. I mean, it's insane because it kind of gives me hope a little bit, because Alex Jones, for example, is being interviewed as like a geopolitical expert now, and not like having him on a show just to laugh at him and call all his theories crazy. And, you know, and I'm not trying to say that you're, you know, I'm not trying to compare you to Alex Jones, but I'm just saying that, like, you, because I know some people will take offense to that. You know, maybe not so much you, because as like many of us who've been down these rabbit holes for many years, will know that a lot of the things he says, there is a lot of substance there. And, you know, the substance is lost in the yelling and screaming and some of the more entertainment part of it. But my point is that a lot of these things that weren't entertained and weren't taken seriously are now taken seriously.
It's a hopeful sign, but it's also a worrying sign, because what's your take on the mainstream alternative media that seems to be popping up in recent years?
Oh, I'd love to talk to you about this, because I've had some disagreements with people about this, and. You know, you get the Russell Brands. Well, first of all, before I assume, who are you referring to? Who would you consider? Dalton?
Russell Brand would be a good name. I think, yeah, there's several names like that. Even someone like Tucker Carlson, who do people remember he used to be the CNN bow tie wearing Crossfire host and all of that? You know, like, he's been in mainstream media circles for decades and decades. And now, suddenly, he's this brave truth teller talking about aliens and JFK and stuff and WTC7. Really? What happened there? There's just a number of figures like that who were very mainstreamy and had mainstream platforms, who are now primarily online and primarily catering towards the independent media. It's an interesting phenomenon. What do you make of it?
Well, personally, I think that it's never too late to see the light, right? If I don't think it's ever too late to, I mean, it's funny, because I go back and forth. We live through COVID, right? And personally, I feel like COVID was one of the craziest times in human history. And I don't say that lightly. I understand, like, you know, there was World War One, World War Two, you know, there was you know, great conflicts throughout human history, but it's one of the few ones that I don't know if there's any comparison to COVID in regards to other ones, because it's the only one that everybody has a COVID story. Like, we experienced it as a planet together. Everybody, we could go to any parts of the world and we can all explain or share our thoughts on, like, what happened, how we handled it, how our country handled it, how our government handled it, how our friends and family handled it, and all the trauma and all the things that we all went through. It's literally the only thing I can think of, because even in the great world wars, there was countries that kind of stayed out of it or were neutral or didn't have a personal experience. Maybe were spectators throughout the whole conflict. So this is the only thing I could think of that, you know, I know of that everybody on the planet went through. And yet, like, even though I'm saying like it's never too late to see the light, I still have some hostility against some people who had some hostility against myself and probably, you know, and people like you who were trying to, I don't want to sound like a religious scholar, like save them. I wasn't trying to save them, but I was trying to help them see what was going on. And I got a lot of pushback. And I also feel like a lot of people got exposed in regards to, like, there's friends of mine that I'm like, okay, you're my friend when things are going well. But when shit hits the fan, for lack of a better term, like, you will turn on me. Like, I'm not certain that you wouldn't turn on me. Or, you know, if I was in hiding from, you know, some imperial government that's, you know, overreaching, you wouldn't throw me under the bus and let them know that I'm hiding out in the, you know, house next door. Do you have that feeling? Like, is there still some hostility?
Yes. I mean, it's hard not to, as you say, when you see what people will really react like when things get real, then yeah, you have to at least take that into account, and not even in a vindictive sense, but just from a, okay, this is who you are. You've shown part of your character with regards to this. So there's that. I actually feel, I'm more upset about the idea that people who were demonstrably wrong on their takes, really everything pre-COVID and then up to COVID, and were wrong at the beginning of COVID and were wrong about it, but then they saw the light. Okay, great. Yeah. But now people act as if those people who were all the way wrong all this time, but now suddenly starting to get things right. And it's like, I'm going to follow that guy rather than the people who have been talking about this since before it happened and were completely right the whole time. That's what I find a bit galling. Again, look, it's not even about a personal vendetta or something. Like, I don't care about these people as human beings because I don't have a friendship relationship with any of them or what have you. It's just the gallingness of the, I guess maybe more so than the people themselves, sure, but their followers who will just blindly follow them when they were wrong. Now they're talking about things that may be right, some of them mixed in with some stuff that's still wrong, but whatever, I'll follow them because they're more entertaining to listen to. I don't know. It's a bizarre thing. Anyway, it all just sounds like sour grapes to people who are listening to this conversation, but I think it speaks to actually a really, really important fundamental part of our society, because what one of the things that we learned over the craziness of this scandemic is just how absolutely, completely, vitally important the free flow of information is and independent thought on issues like this. Whether you agree with all of my takes or all of Ricky's takes or any individual person's, the idea that they can and will squash anyone who is not in line with what the government authorities say is the right thing. Again, anyone who goes along with that and is happy with that has revealed their true character. It's not about whether or not you personally believe that the government was right in every step that it took all along. Even if they were, that still should give you pause for thought when they start squelching and censoring people's right to say what they want to say on these issues. I think that's a pretty important fundamental part of human society. And so, I don't know, let's be as Machiavellian as possible. We are the arch planners of this New World Order, Great Reset. We want the public, as the Great Resetters over at Davos have been saying for years now, we need them back on board. We need to rebuild trust in institutions. How are we going to do that? Hey, we've got all these well-known mainstream media faces. How about we, you know, what do you even call it? It's not whitewash, it's not greenwash, whatever, independent wash these faces. And now they're online independent media entities, and they're talking about all this fun, you know, stuff, aliens and what have you. They're totally truth tellers now, guys. You can trust them. And the next time, whatever happens, happens. Oh, war in Iran? Yeah, we got to go and get those Iranians. Again, there will still be millions and millions of people who follow these people. That's what I'm concerned about. Maybe I'm off my rocker.
Well, you know, I agree with you. There's always a concern. Like, everything seems to be a psyop. So it's almost like everybody's guilty until proven innocent. I'm going to assume everything's a psyop until I can prove that it's not a psyop. You know, I kind of go into a lot of things with that mentality. But I also understand, like, in my own personal life and people close to me, that there have been people that that really would never entertain a conversation with me about vaccines and vaccinate their kids, or entertain this idea of, like, you know, a elite that or depopulation or eugenics or any of these things, or fluoride, or what, you know, or the fact that big food and big pharma is trying to kill people. You know, like, these were not conversations I would have, you know, on a normal basis with people that, you know, for lack of a better term, are normies. And now they are. And there's a lot of people that have woken up to the fact that, well, I mean, personally, I don't know how you could experience what you experienced through 2020 and so on and not wake up. But there's people who, you know, didn't. And but there are many people who did. And I want to believe that maybe it's not just in my personal life. Maybe in media, there's also been some people who have woken up, like a Russell Brand or a Tucker Carlson or whoever it may be, you know, you want to put in that category. But maybe there's a slight chance that they also were kind of blinded to how the world really works, and maybe naive, maybe whatever, you know, term you want to use. And it's possible that they experience the same thing as some of my close friends and family that are now much more open-minded to these other topics. I mean, do you think that could be a possibility in some of these cases?
It certainly could. Let's shift the focus of the conversation. I mean, fundamentally, this isn't about media. This is about how human beings are experiencing this. And I think one of the ways that we can see that most clearly is through the political fissures that have formed in society that, I don't know about you, but certainly throughout my life, I've never seen anything quite like this. It really isn't about left and right in the American context, Democrat, Republican, Canadian context, liberal, conservative, Japanese context, LDP, DPJ. Anyway, it's not about those traditional political divides. It is, I think, more and more about people, I mean, to put it in the scamdemic terms, people who saw through the scamdemic and people who didn't, or people who were willing to question what they were being told by authority versus people who were not willing to question. And as you say, there are people who have come through the craziness of the past few years with their belief in authority and the government and what they did was right and all of the stats and trust the science and all of that intact. But it really does seem like that's like a different society. I won't say you don't belong in the same society as me, because that's not the right way of framing that. But we don't live in the same world. If you went through all of that and you still believe everything that you believed in 2019 and 2024, I don't know what to say to you even. And I think that is the fracture point that we can see society fracturing along. And it's not so much about left and right. It really is about whatever, some sort of ability to question authority, to question what is being told, versus people who will never question it, or seemingly never. I mean, maybe there is a breaking point for everybody, but I don't know how much worse it would have to get than what we saw during this pandemic. So I think that is the real divide that is taking place here. And how does that work itself out? Not just politically, but socially and everything else. Well, I guess we're finding that out gradually. But, you know, weirdly enough, scamdemic, that was like 2 years ago. Stop talking about it. Who cares? I already get that response from some people. So I don't know. I don't even know what to say to people like that who just want to kind of forget it and not talk about it. Probably because they recognize that there is something truly fundamentally transformed in terms of the public discourse over the past few years. And they just don't want to deal with it. There's a lot of things swirling around like that.
Yeah, I think ignorance is bliss for many people, where they'd rather almost live in a world where it's like, okay, I know this isn't I live in a world that's sheltered and maybe not doesn't represent exactly how the world works, but I'm happier this way, and I can smile, and I can, you know, and I think the other option, taking the red pill, it can be scary. And I also think it could have something to do with trauma. Like, I think there's a lot of people who have been traumatized. Yeah. I mean, Mike, I just recently, I was talking to my wife about this, about how, you know, our kids were a little bit on the younger side. My son was born 2015, my daughter in 2016. We had friends over the house all the time. We watched tons of TV, always, you know, went out to the park, did as much as we could do without getting in trouble, and homeschooled, but tried to get them in sports and to keep them around other kids and whatnot. And I'm like, if they were just a little bit older, because I'm like, they were young enough where they didn't quite understand exactly what was going on. Like, I, you know, now my son's, you know, a little bit older. My daughter's a little bit older. Like, we're having much deeper conversations about the world.
Yeah.
Like, if right, they yeah, live yeah. through it right now, I think it would have a permanent effect on them. And maybe, you know, there's still some effects that I'm not quite seeing yet, or maybe we did a good job of making it seem as normal as possible. But I wonder if it's like the world went through this traumatizing situation, and like a lot of humans deal with trauma, is they hide it in the back of their subconscious and they don't they don't visit it until they, you know, they have to or whatnot. And that, I mean, that goes into, it's funny because there's this psychologist that really had this interesting take on trauma and how they think that people are revisiting it too often. Like that psychology can actually be harmful, like a way of dealing with it. Like it's almost, like we look at it as like, oh no, you got to revisit it. You have to talk about it all the time. You have to, and it's like, as you know, like if I am sharing with my wife something that happened at work where I was getting in an argument with somebody and there was tension, while I'm telling the story, I'm reamping that tension again. It's almost like I'm reliving it, right? And I can feel myself getting, it's almost like when I talk about COVID, like there's times on the show where I'm like revisiting what happened and I can feel myself getting upset again. And so I can also see how constantly revisiting something and like bringing out those emotions again, like it gets to a point where it almost becomes harmful, right? It becomes counterproductive, because now, like, maybe it's there's some pros and cons of like keeping it locked away, and also some pros and cons in talking about it. And I think maybe with COVID, there's some people, you know, that's kind of how they're dealing with it. It's almost like pretending it didn't exist, which does make me a little upset. And let me also, we talked about the people who were cowards and didn't come out and say things because it was difficult, because they're worried about getting banned, because they're worried about getting censored, they're worried about being judged by their friends and family, all these things. But we should also give, I don't think we give enough credit to people like yourself and many others in the community that wasn't afraid to talk about these things. Like, we could talk about JFK, we get to have different opinions on 9/11. Like, there isn't a whole lot of backlash if we have, if we push back against the mainstream narrative. But at that time, like, don't let people forget, like, in our personal lives, our opinions was having an effect on our friendships, our, you know, family relationships in our community. Like, it was having real life consequences speaking out. And you know, the people who did it when it was the most difficult, like, I can't thank you guys enough, because honestly, I could do it because you guys did it. Because, like, you know, sometimes I think about that, how, like, the same way listeners would reach out to me, and I'm sure they reached out to you saying that, like, hey, thank you for making me feel sane. Well, guess what? Like, there's other people in the community that were also helping me, because when I was saying, like, this doesn't make sense, and how are people accepting this explanation has no logic, makes no sense. And then I hear you say it, and then I hear Jason Burma say it, and then I hear Ryan Christian from The Last American Vagabond, and I hear Richard Grove, and I hear all these people. I'm like, oh, I'm not going crazy. Like, what I see is actually, you know, doesn't make sense, and I'm not the only one seeing it. So it's like,
yeah,
you know, we all helped each other, and it also goes.
Which, I mean, can you imagine if that had taken place 20 years ago, before there was really an online media to speak of? The only thing you would have heard about the scandemic, all you would have heard about it, other than from your immediate close friends and family, would have been through corporate media. And so you would have heard the one and only line that people were allowed to say. And you wouldn't have even heard if there was some dissenter that was speaking out. They would have been immediately censored and you would never have heard any of that. So, you know, it's interesting the time that we're living through. And yeah, I mean, sometimes it reoccurs to me the sort of the magnitude of what happened there. I mean, I will never have another documentary that will be seen by a million people ever again, because YouTube took away my audience, as it were. I'm not even upset, because I never expected that. I mean, it was an enemy weapons platform that I was using to get the word out, and I was able to do that for almost 15 years or whatever. So yay, you know, good. But I never expected it would last. But anyway, that's gone, because I wouldn't shut up. And I got all the warnings and strikes and you better not talk about this stuff. And I kept talking about it. And I wasn't going to use code words or hide behind anything. I couldn't even imagine doing that. It wouldn't have been me if I had done that. Okay, well, guys, it's cornholio disease and don't get your carrot juice and whatever. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to talk like a 3-year-old babbling child and try to do the tap dance around the authoritarians. I'm just not. And if that means I will never reach a million people again, oh, well, it was fun while it lasted. But, you know, let's go back to that keyword trauma, because actually you talking about that does put into perspective something that I very, very, very seldom consciously think about, because like the fish swimming in water, you never think about the water. I grew up in a loving, supportive household with two parents who loved me and took care of me and put, you know, food on the table, roof over my head. We had a loving, supporting family, and they encouraged me and they were wonderful to me, the best parents anyone could ask for. And that's something I hardly ever think about, because yeah, doesn't everyone have that? Isn't that the way it is? But no. Of course, there are people who deal with trauma that they have had inflicted in them in their childhood from their parents or guardians or people that they trusted most, have had that trust violated, stepped on by narcissistic abusers, whatever. And, you know, that's the kind of thing you're not going to just get over and just move on. It's going to affect you and the way that you approach things in life. So, you know, it's one thing to stand in judgment of people who will never question authority, but who knows what happened to them in their childhood that put them in that frame of mind or what have you. And how do you, rather than lecturing and wagging your finger at such people, how do you get them to process that trauma? Because you're right, yeah, there's a difference between just revisiting trauma over and over and over and over, re-traumatizing yourself every time, and actually processing trauma. Because, yeah, I don't think you should just hide it away and pretend it never happened. But what is the point, for example, of telling your wife about the day that you had and the interaction and whatever? It's not simply just to relive the trauma again. It's to try to process it, to try to put it in some sort of frame and narrative and understand it and then think about, well, how can I approach this differently in the future? And so there is a productive way to approach that. And there are less productive ways of just revisiting trauma and getting re-traumatized every single time. So, you know, I'm not much of a psychotherapist, so I'm not going to be able to do that. And of course, in this type of platform where we're talking to however many people that we don't know and have no idea, you know, we're not looking at them, we're not talking to them. So how can we do that? That's the kind of thing that has to be done on the one-on-one level with friends and family. But anyway, there's a lot of situations out there. And yeah. Mea culpa. I think myself and probably other people probably shouldn't be so finger waggy at every single person. Because again, a lot of people are dealing with trauma on a level that I can't even really properly comprehend.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I think that some of those people who just went along with the narrative and didn't push back, like you said, they're a product of their environment. Their parents were probably the exact same way. They went to school. They were told, always listen to teacher, never ask, you know, too many questions. Don't push back. Don't talk back. All these things. I mean, my wife's like that. And her father's a great person. She comes from a great supportive family, but they've always been rule followers, right? So like, when we're at the grocery store during COVID and there's nobody in the grocery store and there's arrows pointing in the opposite direction that I'm walking, she's telling me not to go down the aisle. And I'm like, I don't give a F. I'm like, it's right there. I'm not going to walk all the way around. There's nobody, you know, I'm the guy who, when there's nobody around and there's a light, the light's red at midnight or 11 o'clock at night and there's nobody on the street, I'm going, you know, like I don't care. You know, I always say, like, I wasn't brainwashed in school because I didn't pay attention in school. You can't brainwash somebody who's not paying attention. I never paid attention, you know, so it was, but coming from, I mean, I think you have a much different background because obviously you, I mean, the reason why you, you know, you end up in Japan was because of education and teaching and whatnot. I'm always curious because I truly do believe that was a part of maybe why I always pushed back because I didn't really pay attention and I didn't really believe in authority or whatnot. But do you think like that's, and we've talked about this in the past, like is it really, can we really just simply say, hey, schooling and this idea of like creating this type of human that just regurgitates information, does what they're told, like, is that like the root cause of our issues? But and then you have examples like yourself where you kind of did, you know, I'm assuming paid attention in school, got decent grades because you end up being an educator yourself. And you didn't, you know, get brainwashed. So like, how does it happen in some cases and not others?
Yeah, it's a good observation because I think it goes back to the same thing we were talking about earlier. That's not about a left or right political orientation. And it's not about schooled or unschooled. There is something that's authoritarian and anti-authoritarian, and it manifests differently in different people. I'm the kind of person that's good at remembering names and dates and facts and regurgitating them on tests, so I always did fine in school. I don't think that's a real marker of intelligence, really. It's a type of intelligence, I guess, rote memorization and regurgitation. But that has nothing to do with authoritarian or anti-authoritarian. And I've always been anti-authoritarian inclined. And that manifested itself for me in that I was the kid that always had his hand up to question the teacher or to say, well, no, you're wrong about that. Or on the test where you're supposed to, I know what the answer is supposed to be, but no, I think it's this. And thankfully, most of the time, with some notable exceptions, most of my teachers were the kind of teachers that actually did encourage that. And that they were appreciative that, hey, this kid's at least... He's at least trying something different. He clearly knows the stuff and he's, you know, fighting back against it. Okay, cool. I generally got away with that most of the time. So that actually didn't really set me back. In people, again, this is one of those things where I had loving, supportive parents. I had teachers that generally were encouraging of my anti-authoritarianism. So it actually wasn't a huge setback for me. But I could certainly imagine people for whom that would not have flown. And those types of anti-authoritarians get, you know, downgraded and held back and what have you in the schooling system simply because their teachers didn't play along with it. Again, it's the million different circumstances that make up our lives. And fundamentally, as I say, I don't think it's about whether you're good at school or whether you're, you know, a Democrat or whatever. It's about whether you are fundamentally authoritarian or not even anti-authoritarian. I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but just someone who will question authority. That's something that's just sort of one of those basic fundamental characteristics that I don't think necessarily match up to any other particular characteristic.
Yeah, and typically, like you said, in most cases, people aren't very happy that you're questioning things. I remember getting in trouble at CCD, which is kind of like a Catholic Sunday school, and I would ask questions and I remember like them getting upset with me and then the lack of answers or the lack of wanting to explore these questions and just telling me like, no, this is, you know, it's black and white. This is how it happened. And this is why you should believe this and whatever, pushed me away from any type of religion or I became very, I guess for lack of a better term, like a atheist or anti-religious for many, many years. And, you know, I haven't done the Adam Curry, you know, born again Christian type of thing, but he's but I definitely have gotten to the point where I've, you know, now I'm just like, okay, I wasn't anti-spirituality or, you know, religion. I was really just pushing back against these people who just didn't let me ask questions and whatnot. And then I kind of grouped in organized religion with spirituality, and I just assumed, oh, it's kind of the same thing. So I'm anti all that woo-woo stuff. And now as time goes by, I find myself debating friends of mine that are atheists and kind of like, well, you know, you're saying that, you know, the religious people have, you know, they have it all figured out, and how could they have it all figured out? But I'm like, you sound pretty certain with your worldview too, you know, so you sound just as extreme in your views and certain in your views as they do. So you're just, you know, you're just on a different team, but you have the same type of blinders per se. So it's wild, but I, you know, and this goes into, before I get off topic, I do want to ask you about, because you did talk about getting banned off YouTube. I also, as my listeners know, got kicked off YouTube during COVID for the same reasons as you, you know, not wanting to self-censor or whatnot. But I was curious because one thing I did notice after getting banned off YouTube, that it wasn't just YouTube. Google searches. I was suppressed on Google searches. I was suppressed. So like when you talk about like, it's not just a platform, you are put on, because Google and YouTube's the same company, you are put on a blacklist. And then after I got banned off YouTube, I would, much like yourself, I have an archive of many different topics. So I would talk to a friend or family like, hey, you've done a show on this topic. I'm like, yeah, you know, I'll send it to you. And I'm like on Google. A lot of times I'll just Google myself and I'd be like, okay, here's the show. Here's the guest. I spell things wrong all the time and Google figures it out. No problem. And now I'm spelling everything correctly, putting the information correctly, and it's not coming up. And then I'm like, oh crap. Like this is bigger than just being suppressed on YouTube.
Yeah.
I'm suppressed on everything. Did you experience that?
Oh yeah. But to be fair, I was already experiencing it before I even got kicked off YouTube. They've definitely been jiggering the algorithms and limiting search for years and years now. And, one of the most obvious examples I've talked about several times, so my listeners will be sick to death of it, but it was just an obvious blatant example. So, 2017, 18, I don't know, somewhere in there, the MSNBC host, man, I'm forgetting his name at the moment. Yay. Good. 'Cause I don't care. Anyway, what's his name? One of those MSNBC hosts with the punchable face. Oh, wait, that's all of them. But anyway, he was tweeting. He started this tweet thread about the dangers of, you know, the internet and whatever, blah, blah, blah. And basically his premise was, imagine you are a high school student who's assigned to do a project on the Federal Reserve. So you go to YouTube and type in Federal Reserve and you get this, and he posts a screenshot of my Century of Enslavement documentary. And the whole thing was like, oh my God, you see how YouTube is leading to this crazy conspiracy content, blah, blah, blah. Because for several years there, from the documentary was released 2014, so for 3 or 4 years or whatever it was, until this Chris Matthews, that's his name, until Chris Matthews started his tweet thread, it was the number one search result for Federal Reserve. If you went to YouTube and you typed in Federal Reserve, the first thing that would pop up, Century of Enslavement. Cool, right? As I say, millions, reaching millions of people. But, of course, oh my God, this is horrible. So literally, he posts that tweet thread literally the next day. You go to YouTube and you type in Federal Reserve. Suddenly, no Century of Enslavement. Suddenly, you type in Century of Enslavement into the YouTube algorithm, search algorithm, and you could get a post of it, but not my post, like a repost on someone else's channel. And even then you'd have to dig through several results. And they continued refining that, you know, within a few months, basically, even if you use Century of Enslavement, you couldn't find the documentary. So it was, you know, it was pretty blatant. It was obvious. And I did have contact with one of those Google whistleblower people who said that, yeah, Corbett Report was on their search list, whatever, behind the scenes to throttle the traffic, of course. And, you know, that I did a report. I can't remember which report it was now. Maybe not the future of censorship. I think we need to talk about search, I think is what it was called. Anyway, where I talked about this, and the real penny drop for me, like, well, okay, yeah, I get it. But why are they so concerned about this? And the penny drop moment happened for me when we were staying at a hotel one night. And because I don't have a smart TV in the home, we're there and, oh, it's a smart TV. Oh, I see. Oh, and you can access YouTube and you can, you know. And so, of course, the search term, what comes up in the first few results of a search term is incredibly important now, because it's not like people are sitting there at a keyboard, at a desk, you know, typing and refining searches and clicking around here and there. No, it's like Alexa. It's like a smart TV. You ask a question and here's the top five results and that's it. And what are you going to do? You're not going to sit there trying to refine your search or whatever. This is Federal Reserve. Oh, okay. So that's why I think, obviously, they've been so concerned about refining search results. But as Ryan Christian, Last American Vagabond, pointed out, and I always like to repeat this, they broke themselves censoring us. Because, yeah, search, I don't know if you've noticed, I certainly have noticed, search is getting worse and worse. And not just for my content, obviously, but for any sort of, literally any content. It's getting harder and harder to find things that, one, absolutely are there, and two, used to be easily findable. But now it's this big process of you got to search seven ways from Sunday and, oh, wait, okay, so how about this search term? And maybe I should include this and let's put this in quotation marks. And finally, you might be able to find it. And even then, I use a bunch of different search engines for everything that I do, because I'll find that on all of these different search engines, I will have like an exact quotation in quotation marks, exact phrase, search for this, and it won't pop up. And still, to this day, one of the only search engines where when I have that problem, I can go to Google and put it in the quotation marks and it will pop up. So, you know, it is crazy. But it goes back to fundamentally the question of access to information is, in some ways, maybe even more important than the information itself, or at least equally important. Because if you cannot find it, if you cannot get to it, what good is it, right? It might as well not exist if you can't find a way into it. So yeah, they're clearly obsessed with censoring our way into finding information. And as I was pointing out in that video, we need to talk about search. It's because eventually this whole, you know, desktop keyboard access to information is going to go the way of the dodo. It already is. More and more people are just relying on smartphones, tablets, Alexa, whatever, smart TVs. And it's essentially, as James M. Pilato, Media Monarchy, says, it's a vending machine. You know, they don't want you to have access to something where you can produce and refine search results and, you know, do things for yourself. No, it's going to be sort of a, hey, Alexa, what happened on 9/11? On September 11th, 2001, 19 men armed with, it's going to devolve down to that, and we're not going to have much say over it. So I think that's, you know, it's almost like there's going to be a hardware winnowing of this access to information that will make any sort of software or, you know, web access almost irrelevant.
Yeah, and this goes into, and I'm going to tie all these topics together, or at least attempt to. And so this kind of goes into AI a little bit, because the same faith that people have on their smartphone to answer a question, I hear people talk about AI like they're going to solve the world's problems. And it boggles my mind, because really smart people are saying this. And I'm just like, I'm thinking to myself, like, isn't that AI programmed? Isn't it fed information? Isn't it, in other words, influenced by humans and their thoughts and opinions and worldviews? And we just talk about AI like, hey, whatever information it gives us or whatever solution it gives us, yeah, it must be correct, completely ignoring the fact that it is going to be influenced by whoever programs it.
Yes. And necessarily so. This is the part that most people in our current day and age cannot wrap their minds around, because we've been so thoroughly conditioned into a certain mindset. But let me stress the most important part of this. People think that there is some way that you could have a completely objective set of data about whatever, September 11th, or anything else you can think of. There is not. The only way we can process such things is through narrative. there is a story structure, which is the coordinating structure for anything of interest that we want to narrow down on, including 9/11. Tell me what happened on 9/11 without putting it into any sort of narrative structure or form. I mean, let's just imagine we have this supercomputer that knows literally everything that happened on that day, and it would just start listing them. Well, at 12 midnight in Timbuktu, there was a bird flapping its wings. At 12:01 in Taipei, there was a butterfly on this flower. On 12:00, that's not what I mean. I mean, tell me about the World Trade Center and all of that. Well, again, if you can get down to the atomic level of exactly what happened with each atom of each, you know, thing that was interacting with each other. But that's not what we're talking about. No, we're talking about the narrative. We're talking about the structure of, okay, no, there were these terrorists that did this thing, or there was this government plot, or whatever it is. It is a narrative. And in order to arrive at that, you have to winnow out the 18 trillion or 856 quadrillion things that you could talk about with relation to those events. You got to narrow it down to the things. No, what I'm interested in with regards to those events. And that is a subjective narrative process. There is no way that anyone or any supercomputer could do that without some sort of human influence, without some sort of human ordering process of what is the narrative and how do we do that? Until people understand that our experience of reality, whether or not reality itself is a narrative, which I think you could almost fruitfully argue, but anyway, that's irrelevant. Our experience of reality is inherently through narrative. There are 18 million things that I could look at and process in this room right now. But the only thing I'm really looking at and processing right now is this camera and the screen showing me your view, how you're reacting to what I'm saying, etc. And that's because the narrative of what is happening right now is we are engaged in conversation, and my aim is to try to say things that you will understand and process and then respond to things that you say to me. That's so I am using all of my conscious powers to narrow down on the narrative of what is happening in this room right now. And we all are doing that at all times in everything that we do. When we see a bicycle, we don't see 8 million different parts and things and, you know, the labels and what have you. We see a thing that we can, I can get on and I can ride so that I can go down to the store and buy whatever. That's the way that our brains function and process reality. And it is embedded in narrative. So there is no supercomputer that's going to come along and tell you just the straight facts about the universe that isn't in some way through some sort of narrative lens. And yes, AI, large language models, really, can only be trained on our perceptions of the universe that are inherently narrative embedded. So there is going to be a narrative, and it is, of course, it's going to be human influenced because that's the way these algorithms are processing information. So until we can truly appreciate that, unfortunately, as you say, more and more people are treating this like the Oracle, and I even see it from people in my own audience who told me, well, I was asking ChatGPT the other day about this, and it told me that. And it's always presented in this way, like, well, ChatGPT said it, so it must be true. It's worrying, and it's worrying precisely because it speaks to a fundamental misunderstanding that I think most people buy into, is that there is some objective point of view of the universe that we could just totally strip out all narrative and it could just present the cold hard facts. That don't exist. I hate to burst your bubble, but sorry, we don't live in that universe. We live in one that is inherently narrative based, and that involves humans with their subjective biases that you'll never, ever, ever, ever escape.
Do you think we also inherently have to believe in something, and there almost seems to be, you know, during COVID, we talked about the spiritual battle, right? It's almost like we could feel the good versus evil that was going on the planet, right? And everybody kind of sensed it. And a lot of people who weren't spiritual, that weren't people who believed in like energy or sensing those type of things, they couldn't ignore it. And there was tension that you could feel. And where do you think this is going? Like, zooming out, like I try to sometimes, like, it's wild because there's so many theories, right? Like, is there a battle between this robot AI who's trying to be created, manipulating humans to be created, and you know, is there something like that going on? Are we taking baby steps into a future that will include some Terminator type of ending where it's like the materialist people who believe in robots and think they could be our saviors, and then the humans who try to live a more organic life that's more attached to Mother Nature and in harmony with Mother Nature. I'm trying to zoom out. I'm like, what's this big picture? Because sometimes we get so we're like caught up in just the weeds, and we're, you know, paying attention to what's going on at everyday event. But I'm like, these big questions are not just important, they're intriguing, because it's like something is happening and I don't know what is happening, but I feel like we're in the midst of something. Like, what's your thoughts?
There's no doubt we're going through existentially important times, and on almost any level of analysis that you could think about, from the geopolitical to the scientific to everything else. And as examples of that, I mean, I still keep going back to the fact that, yeah, you know, we're tinkering with species at the genomic level now, and we are literally tinkering and doing gene therapies that we now call vaccines, and doing these vast uncontrolled experiments on literally billions of human beings, formerly human beings. What are they now when they get tinkered with in certain ways? At any rate, as crazy as that might sound, it certainly is the direction that we're tending. Or when it comes to, for example, the large language models, and I don't know if I'd be willing to ascribe, you know, I understand the narrative of, you know, the AI is struggling to be born and manipulating us and what have you. Okay, fair enough. But I know a lot of people won't see it in that way, and I don't necessarily do either. But at the very, very least, it is clearly and a truly, truly revolutionary technology. And people who deny that really are living in La La Land. For generations, the defining feature of whether artificial intelligence is artificial intelligence or not has been the Turing test. But now that LLMs can largely, depending how you want to do it, but generally could pass the Turing test, it's like, oh yeah, that's not important. That's just a bunch of code. No, that's actually an extremely, extremely important thing that has just happened. And now, given the types of, hey, AI, generate me a picture of this, instantly you get, you know, 8,000 pictures of that. Video is coming online. It's getting crazier and crazier. And yeah, it's one of those things where people scoffed at the internet back in the early 1990s. The internet, who cares? Why would I want email? What does any of this mean? In the same way, people will look back 20 years from now at the way that people were scoffing at these large language models. Ah, that doesn't mean anything. Oh, yeah? So, but what does it mean? And at the very, very least, I think it's safe to say that all technology, all technological advance is seen first and foremost through the lens of power, control, weaponry. That is how technological advance has always functioned, how it has always been progressed and forwarded, how it has been constrained, restrained, or unleashed in various ways. And there is no doubt that there are people who are seeking ways to weaponize this technology. In fact, we're already starting to see it. The idea of drone swarms and what have you being unleashed, Lavender AI being used to target people in Gaza, etc. It's, yeah, we're really on the cusp of some fundamental transformations, and it's difficult to see a way through this that will end happily. Let's put it that way, because there are so many ways that this could go wrong. Even if AI is all overhyped BS, it is clearly changing certain processes and the ways that certain things function. Like it or not, you have the AI-powered fighters, drones, and what have you that can win against human fighter jets 100% of the time in simulations and tests, right? It's already coming, and it will be used against the public. And so the real question is whether or not we will be able to essentially protect ourselves from what is coming. And what is the way to do that? And of course, there will be the people that tell you, well, we'll have to adopt the technology and use it for ourselves in order to protect ourselves. We'll need the AI drone protector to protect us from the other AI drones or what have you. And maybe that is true. I don't know. But maybe there's ways that we can think about becoming original substrate humans and embracing that and detaching ourselves from the technological society. But we're not even close to that actually becoming a reality. And yet this technology is already knocking at our door. So yeah, we're facing some incredibly existentially profound questions. And I think most people are just stumbling into that minefield happily. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, it's weird. It's like we're unknowingly self-destructing. We're doing it to ourselves, the human race, and without a care in the world. Like we don't even know that we're doing it. Like we're creating our end. So yeah, I see you looking at the time. You probably got another interview, knowing your schedule.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got a presentation to record for a thing that I'm doing. It's the Liberty on the Rocks festival, conference, what have you, that's coming up in Sedona, Arizona, November 1st to 3rd, if I remember correctly. Anyway, people can look it up. I will not be there in person. I'm recording a presentation for it that I will send them via video, so people can check that out if they're interested.
Awesome. You got any documentaries or any bigger projects that you got coming out anytime soon that people should look forward to?
Well, define soon. Anyway, I am always working on stuff. And at the very least, in the very, 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 very near term, I just released an editorial on The Strange Story of Peter Thiel.
I saw that.
Talking about that character. And really, that it's, I think, 3,500 words or something, but that's really just sort of the preamble to what is coming next weekend, which will be the conclusion of that strange story. And it gets pretty weird. So I hope people will check that out. It's available at my site or on my Substack.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you, James. Always a pleasure talking. And hopefully we'll do it again much sooner than from this one.
Yeah. And, yeah. It's been a while.
It has been a while. I think we both got a little busy and then, you know, and whatnot. And I know you're always putting out tons of content and whatnot, but always one of my favorite conversations, one of the first guests to ever come on the Ripple Effect podcast. And I'm glad that we still chat from time to time and we'll keep it going.
Thanks. You know what? Let me just take a moment to acknowledge. I'm glad you're still around because there's a lot of podcasts that come and go. But you've been doing this. How many years have you been doing it now?
2013.
Yeah.
So, and I still cannot figure out.
In podcasting terms, that's basically a century. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And that I'm so bad business wise that I still can't figure out how to make a living doing this. So, that puts in perspective how bad I am. But it's a a passion project. And, you know, obviously you've found a way to do it for a living, but you were doing it for many years prior to that. And obviously you're still doing it, even though you're being blacklisted and YouTube's making it much harder for you to expand. I think we both come from a music background. We both love music. I think the musicians, and also it's true for all people in the alternative media community, content creators. I think if you're in it for the right reasons, you continue doing
it. Yeah. Yeah. You don't get into music because some people maybe do get into music because they think you're going to be rich and famous, but chances are you're not.
Yeah.
And same thing with this. Yeah. If you get into it because I'm going to be rich and famous doing a podcast, you're probably not.
Yeah. Well, at least not talking about the things that we talk about. I mean, I think
fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, there's that guy who came out with the YouTube or Google book about exactly like how to make content that will reach people, and like the simple things like, you know, like make a video about like, what's the difference between the two different types of screwdrivers, and you'll get a million, you know, it's like, cause the things that people search for the most are super simple. Yeah. And I'm like, but who wants to make a living doing that type of meaningless content? I don't know, whatever. But anyways,
I suppose when I start putting out those kind of videos, you'll know.
You're desperate.
Oh, James is finally sold out. All right.
Thanks, James. We'll talk again. And all good right. luck with all your future projects.
Thanks, all right. Man. Thanks. Take care. Thank you. Thanks, James.
I believe in the ripple effect.